Today we're going to be focusing on the point of Daniel's life. We're also going to be focusing on the point of your life. What is the point? What is the purpose? Mark Batterson said this, one of his books, "It's time to quit living as if the purpose of life is to arrive safely at death." Because brothers and sisters, it's not. Put your hand up if you've ever gone skydiving before. Any of us? A couple. Okay. Larry, too. Wow, awesome. A couple of us, right? So skydiving is a big deal. I'll just say this. Once is enough for me. I went to a place not too far from here. It was a part of a friend's bachelor party before kids, and it was a tandem jump, so a little bit less dangerous. You're strapped to a professional. Nevertheless, there's still only a parachute between you and death, so, you know. Anyway, what I want to share with you about that experience is what it looked like from way up 10,000 feet in the sky. So you go up there, you're up 10,000 feet, the door of this little plane opens, and you put your foot out on the side about to jump. And as you look down, it's amazing because things look very different up there than they look down here. So I was amazed. These farmers' fields looked like squares on a chessboard. You could just turn your head 30 degrees and you could see like the neighboring town. Now, if you were down, you know, on the ground level, you wouldn't be able to see that because you couldn't see over the trees of the horizon. You could see how the roads all work together, the road structure, road system. But if you're on the road, you wouldn't be able to see that bigger picture of how it all fits together. So there's something about the perspective. Well, today is going to be like that in a sense. We are going to rise up into the sky, kind of metaphorically speaking, and what we're going to do is we're going to take the 10,000-foot view of the book of Daniel. We are going to maybe see things that maybe we wouldn't otherwise be able to see if we're just going through the text verse by verse, line by line, as we have been doing for the last little while. And we're going to see a big picture theme, something come to the fore about the point of Daniel's life, and this is going to help us see the point of our own lives. As we've been saying, Daniel was a man of single, solitary devotion to God, and he is just one of those amazing, inspiring, enduring examples of what it is to live faithfully in a foreign land. And so for the past 4 months, we have been going through the entire book of Daniel. Today is a summary, a review. We've been going through chapter by chapter. And kind of our approach has been, what we're trying to do is go through each chapter, and we're saying, okay, what is something that although Daniel lived in the 6th century BC, it's a long time ago, what's something about his faith, his attitude, his life that we can take and apply to our own lives today, even though we are living a far ways from him? Brian Irwin, who is a former Old Testament professor of mine, speaking about Daniel, wrote in one of his books, "The book of Daniel was not written to us. Nonetheless, it bears a message for us, namely how God's people ought to navigate a world that is foreign and not naturally inclined toward the will of God." And we can kind of relate to that. Our world doesn't always seem naturally inclined toward the will of God. So although not originally written to us, it nevertheless bears a message for us. And so our approach today is kind of threefold. First step is we're going to again remind ourselves what it was like to be in Daniel's shoes. Now, we did this a lot early in the series, especially as we went through chapters 1, 2, and 3. What was it like to be in Daniel's shoes leading up to some of those early stories in his life? Second, we're going to look at three passages that are critical. I think they kind of foreground the heart or essence of the book as a whole. We'll take a quick look at those three. And then finally, we're going to arrive at the final key theme that bears on the point of Daniel's life and also helps us reflect on the point of our own lives. Okay, so first, we're going to try yet again to put ourselves in Daniel's shoes. So God's people lived under both blessing and warning. If they were faithful to God, good things would happen. And if they were unfaithful to God, bad things would happen. Lo and behold, Daniel's ancestors betrayed God repeatedly. They didn't listen to the law of Moses. They didn't heed Isaiah. They didn't heed Jeremiah. Now, God, through Scripture, we find that he's always slow to anger. He's patient, abounding in steadfast love. But over time, in the fullness of time, time is up. As a result, judgment came on the nation and Daniel's entire generation. Now, remember that Daniel, at the start, was only like 15 years old, maybe 17, maybe 18. A lot of scholars say 15 years old. So think of a young person in these early days, really with so much of his life spreading out before him. God's judgment on the nation came in the form of a foreign superpower, Babylon and their king Nebuchadnezzar. Their takeover of Judah and the capital city of Jerusalem came in three stages. Daniel and his friends were deported during the first stage. It's reasonable to assume that many of Daniel's friends and family members were killed during those attacks and during that evasion. Remember, he's a young man, many of them killed. And so they are taken as captives to Babylon. Now, how did they get there? We're not totally sure. Some historians speculate it might have been something called a death march. And a death march is something where captives are stripped naked, they are chained together, and they have to walk a journey which would have been roughly over 1,200 kilometers. Now, it would have been quicker if they'd gone straight, but they couldn't really survive the heat and the hostility of the Arabian desert. So they probably took a trade route through the north. And so they go all this way. Now, it's also likely that they didn't have a death march, that they were taken maybe in caravans, because Daniel was of nobility. So they wanted to use him in the foreign court. And if it's too harsh on him, the trip, and he dies, then he's no use to them, and they get to the foreign land. Daniel and his friends were possibly, I say probably, castrated upon their arrival. This is to better serve the royal interests, and we get this detail from Isaiah 39, verses 5 to 7. So just think of this. Not only is this physically painful to experience castration, but there was certainly mental, emotional heartache. Imagine the prospect of children or grandchildren being taken from you forever. You get captured, you get sent to a foreign land, and guess what? You get renamed. And this renaming is a part of your assimilation in the new culture. So renaming is often about helping you forget your identity and culture. They then underwent a 3-year training period to serve the king and nation who has just destroyed and taken almost everything that they have known and loved. In part one of the series, after reviewing all that, after trying to get into Daniel's shoes, thinking about what he has gone through, I asked just a question. Who are we when absolutely everything is stripped away? Right? Because that's certainly, at least physically, the experience that Daniel and his friends had. Virtually almost everything is stripped away. And I told a story by Arthur Miller in one of his books, Incident at Vichy. He talks about this upper middle class man. He's a Jewish man. And Nazis have come over and taken over their village, and everyone has to present themselves before the Nazi authorities. And this man, very respectable man, he comes and he shows his university degrees. He shows his letters of reference from prominent citizens, other documents like that. And the soldier says, "Is this all you have?" And the man answers, "Yes." And the soldier takes all the documents, throws them in the garbage, and says, "Good, now you have nothing." Evil. This must surely have been something like what Daniel experienced as a young man. And so as he would go and grow throughout his life, who would he turn out to be after so much, after absolutely everything is taken away? And that was an opportunity for us to ask, okay, who are we? Imagine if we had family or friends or diplomas or bank accounts or job or anything that kind of was a marker about our status or our life taken away. Who would we be in those moments? As we went through the book of Daniel, one of the things we also learned is that Daniel served in the foreign court for roughly 70 years. Think of that. That's a long time. That's the vast majority of his life. And when we read through the book of Daniel, maybe you jump in the middle at a story like Daniel in the lion's den, as we talked about when we were at that chapter. We think, okay, we kind of assume that Daniel's a young man in the prime of his life. But as you go through the book, there's these different chronological markers that tell us how old he is progressing as we go through the story. In the lion's den, he's in his early 80s. And so this just reminds us that this has taken up the vast, vast majority of his life. And so hopefully that quick review just kind of helps us get back into Daniel's shoes. Now, second, we're going to look at three sections of text which I think capture the heart and essence of the book as a whole. And here's the first. It's Daniel 3, verses 14 to 18. Now, this is the story of the fiery furnace. This is one of the most famous stories in the book, right? And it's actually not about Daniel at all. It's about his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the background, of course, is that the king has erected this huge statue. And as we talked about when we were in chapter 3, most likely not pure gold, most likely gold-plated. Some people think that this was maybe a statue of the king himself. I tend to think that it was one of the Babylonian deities, perhaps Nabu or Marduk. Nevertheless, people are called to bow down to this. But this is a problem for Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego because they're Jews. They're the people of God. And so they don't want to do that. It's idolatry, and it's actually specifically prohibited in the Ten Commandments. So what's going to happen? This happens, and they refuse, making the king furious with rage. Let's pick it up at verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." So in the NIV translation of that, in verse 18, it says, "But even if he does not," and we focused on those two words, "even if." We even had little stickers made up. Do you remember that? That phrase, even if he does not. We know that our God will save us and that he can save us, but even if he does not, we will still not bow down and serve you or your gods. They would rather die faithfully than live falsely. And so this actually reveals one of the major themes of the faith, of the book, an even if kind of faith. And we see it here in multiple ways. Even if Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were pressured to abandon their God, they said, "No, we will honor God first." Even if they had all their reputation and status that was going to be built up in this foreign nation, even if all that would be stripped away, no, they would serve God first. Even if they came face to face with the flames and with the pain of death, no, they would honor God first. The second representative story skips ahead a couple of chapters to Daniel chapter 6, verses 6 to 10. And this is another one of the stories that is very famous, right? So that's a similar theme to the previous story. This is the one of the lion's den, and it is also a question of loyalty. And so the background quickly, as you recall, is that basically Daniel has been rising in prominence and authority and influence. Other people are jealous of Daniel. They want to trap him and trick him. And so they get the king to pass a law that no one can pray to anyone except the king. Now, to us today, that seems strange. Now, what we need to know is that back in the ancient world, it wouldn't have been as strange to them as it seems to us today. And part of the reason is because royalty, many kings were felt to have divine qualities. So it was not uncommon totally to pray to kings. Not only, but Babylon had expanded in size. So it's most likely an act to consolidate political loyalty throughout the realm. Nevertheless, they know that Daniel is loyal only to his God. He will only pray to him. And so a trap has been set. It's dangerous. And we pick it up at verse 6. "Then these high officials and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, 'O King Darius, live forever.' All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and injunction." Verse 10, critical verse. "When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house, where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously." So the story, although dangerous, is simple. The injunction comes through and Daniel says no. And in fact, he goes home and he goes up to the second floor to an open window so that he can pray facing Jerusalem. People are trying to trap him. He knows he's going to get caught, but he prays anyway. He could have gone onto the closet, but he doesn't. He prays anyway, right? And also, he doesn't pray haphazardly. He prays consistently. Notice that verse 10 says he prays three times a day. Not only does he do that, but he does so as he had done previously, meaning that Daniel hasn't started a new practice. He's simply doing something that he has always done. Of course, he's caught, he's thrown into the den, and God, by his grace, rescues him. And so, Much like his friends who were threatened with the fiery furnace, this story is an evidence of an even if kind of faith. Even if he is pressured to abandon his God, he's like, no, I'm going to honor God first. Even if he would have all his reputation, status, authority, influence stripped that had been built up over the years that he had been there, even if all of that would be taken away, even if he, no, I will honor my God first. Third scenario, even if he had to face the pains of the lions, and we played a soundtrack of lions on that Sunday, if we recall, to help us get us in the frame of mind about how scary and dangerous that would be. Even if he had to face that, no, he will honor God first. The third representative story comes to us in the next chapter, Daniel 7, verses 11 to 14. And so the second half of the book, as we discovered, had different kinds of stories, a different kind of feel. The first half, many of those ones we know and love, the most famous. The second half included a series of visions, four visions about worldly battles and things that would lead up even to the end of the days, right? So these are very dramatic, very exciting, and challenging at some points. For those of us who know people who say, oh, reading the Bible is boring, those people haven't read the actual Bible. They certainly haven't read Daniel 7. For example, in chapter 7, there was a vision of four terrifying beasts. Each of these beasts represented these human kingdoms, but then something else happened, and we pick it up at verse 11. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. So recall that in chapter 7, that horn was a part of that fourth beast, right? And it was speaking powerful things, evil things. And as I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Okay, here we go. Verse 13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, that's God the Father, and was presented before him. And to him, to the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. And so this is a very enigmatic passage of text because this individual is called a Son of Man, but at the same time, clearly described with divine qualities. And so we made the connection when we were in chapter 7 that what is the title that Jesus uses most frequently to describe himself? It's Son of Man. Not only that, but when Jesus is facing trial and if he is asked if he's the Messiah, and he says that he is, he then goes on to quote this very line from Daniel 7. And a part of the reason this is hopeful to people then and also to us now is it tells us, despite the ragings of the world that were really rampant in the time of Daniel and that continue into our own day, there is still reason to hope because we actually belong not to the kingdoms of this broken world, but to an everlasting kingdom. And so even this story is an example of an even-if kind of faith. Even if the nations rage, hope is still possible because we actually belong to an everlasting kingdom, which is the coming kingdom of Jesus. Even if we're not sure how all the pieces of history fit together and things are chaotic and this really stresses us out and makes us anxious and worried, hope is still possible because we actually belong to an everlasting kingdom. The kingdom of the coming Jesus. Even if our lives, in the midst of all this chaos, feel like they're going sideways sometimes, there is still reason to hope because we actually belong to an everlasting kingdom, which is the coming kingdom of Jesus. It's an even if kind of faith. So I think those three passages are representative of the essence and heart of the book as a whole. So third, let's get into the key theme to do with the point of Daniel's life. The point is to point to God. The point is to point to God. The point of Daniel's life was to point to God. In fact, it was the point of the lives of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as well. And when I say the point, I'm talking about the purpose, the meaning. Why in the world are we here on earth? And it's a vital question. And everyone wants to know about the point of life or about the purpose of life. In his book, Man's Search for Meaning, psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who is also a survivor, concentration camp survivor, highlights a study of students being asked, hey, what is really important to you? 16% said money. 78%? Nearly 4 to 5, 78% said finding purpose and meaning for my life. This is a question that is so vitally important, and people look all sorts of places for answers. Many people try to look to science for the answer to many of these questions, but there are certain things that science and the scientific method simply cannot explain. The scientific method cannot explain how physical matter even got here. It cannot explain forgiveness or love, and it certainly cannot explain the purpose or point of our lives. Now, the second part of that phrase is to point to God. Now, obviously, we're not talking about fingers and road signs. This is theological shorthand for prioritizing God, honoring God, knowing God, serving God, celebrating God, and reflecting God, because we are made in His image. And those are important words, and I'm going to repeat them a couple times over the next few minutes. Prioritizing God, honoring God, knowing God, serving God, celebrating God, and reflecting God. And there are different ways that the Christian tradition all over the world has tried to articulate or summarize the heart of what this means. One of them is called the Westminster Catechism. It was written in the 17th century, and it says, what is the chief end of man? What is the chief end of man? So we might not use that language today if we were writing it today. If so, we might use words like, what is a person's primary purpose? What is a person's primary purpose? And the answer is just so beautiful. It's to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. To glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. Several years ago, I was leading a high school discussion group called HiQ. High school students, IQ, smart high school students. HiQ. And great discussions, really, really smart young people. And we were talking about this idea of glorifying God. You know, 1 Corinthians 10:31, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. And someone said, if we're supposed to be like God and God wants us to glorify Him, it kind of seems selfish of God. And this young woman was really onto something. So you know, why would He want us to focus on Him so much when He focuses on others? Doesn't it seem kind of selfish of God? Great question. Think of it like this. Imagine there's this theme park, okay? Here's this theme park, but different parts of the theme park are different. And there's this part of the theme park over here. It's a corner. It's kind of dark and dingy. You don't want to go there. Over here, there's all the food, but let me tell you that a lot of the food is kind of past due. Over here, there's some rides, but the maintenance crew hasn't really been there in about 7 years, so I'm not sure you want to go there. But over here in this part of the theme park, it's amazing. There's lights and there's laughter and everything works and there's feasting and there's peace and there's joy. It's amazing. So if my kids are going to go into the theme park, am I going to say, yeah, just go to whatever park you want. Doesn't really matter. That's not really loving of me to say to them, because actually I know there's a part of the park that is better. I'm going to be directing them that way, right? They're going to have a much different experience if they go to the good part of the park. And to make the connection, God is that good part of the theme park. And so if God is actually the best thing there is, He is always good, holy, wise, loving, true, it's actually unloving of Him to direct His children other places. The best thing for us is to focus on the things that are good, holy, wise, loving, true. The point is to point to God, and our lives are the most meaningful, the most purposeful when we do that. Daniel and his friends used their lives, as difficult as they were, to point to God. Now, it's worth asking at the end of the series when we get here, whatever happened to Daniel? We don't totally know. Right toward the end of the book, we know that many of his contemporaries actually got to go back to Judah and Jerusalem. That's great. But we're never told that Daniel was among them. In fact, as far as we know, he stayed serving in the foreign court. Why didn't he go back? We don't totally know. He's serving in a high-ranking position, perhaps at this time, because he is now in his late 80s or early 90s. Maybe his health was such that he couldn't go back. But does that mean that his life was a waste? Absolutely not. Because he spent his life pointing to the greatness of God, and that's actually the true measure of things. And by that I mean prioritizing God, honoring God, knowing God, serving God, celebrating God, reflecting God. But Matthew, Daniel was taken from his homeland. Doesn't that kind of mean that his life kind of missed the mark because it never really was what it was supposed to be? Of course not. He spent his life focusing on the greatness of God, and that's actually the true measure of things. But Matthew, he went through so much pain and disappointment. In fact, he wasn't able to have any kids. Doesn't that mean that his life kind of missed the mark? Absolutely not. He focused his time and attention on pointing to the greatness of God, and that's actually the true measure of things. But Matthew, he had people who betrayed him, and he got old, and he never got to return to Jerusalem. Doesn't this mean that his life somehow missed the mark? Of course not. He spent his time and energy pointing to the greatness of God, and that's actually the true measure of things. And the same thing can be true for all of us. The point is to point to God, and this fills our life with purpose, and it actually liberates us from all the false and misguided expectations that people put on us and that we put on ourselves. Now, it's going to be different for all of us, the specifics, right? We know that. We have different personalities, different life experiences, different strengths. People are at different ages, and I get that. And it's going to look in the specifics different for the musician than the office manager than the teacher than the grandma who looks after her grandkids 4 days a week. I get that. But the beautiful thing that they all have in common is this: prioritizing God, honoring God, knowing God, serving God, celebrating God, reflecting God. The founder of Habitat for Humanity has said, "The happiest, most satisfied, most fulfilled people I know are concerned with something bigger than themselves." I wonder what the 90-year-old Daniel would say to the 15-year-old Daniel. Ever wondered about that? Imagine them. So much experience and hardship between them. The 90-year-old Daniel and the 15-year-old Daniel. I sometimes wonder, and my guess is that he would say something like this to his younger self: "You know what? No matter what happens, no matter what difficulties you face, glorify God and your life will not be wasted." But Matthew, my life is not turning out like I planned. Doesn't that mean that I've somehow missed the mark? Absolutely not. Focus on pointing to the greatness of God, because that's actually the true measure of things. But Matthew, my life has included so much difficulty and loss. Yeah, I know it's hard. Does that mean my life has somehow gone sideways and has somehow missed the mark? Of course not. Focus your life on pointing to the greatness of God. That's actually the true measure of things. But Matthew, I have so many worries and my future is so uncertain. I lie awake at night. Doesn't that mean that my life has somehow missed the mark? Of course not. Focus yourself on pointing to the greatness of God. That's actually the true measure of things. The point is to point to God. It's true for the 15-year-old Daniel. It's true for the 90-year-old Daniel. And it's true for all of us 2,500 years later. In his book, Supernatural, Michael Heiser writes this: "We are God's agents to restore Eden in the here and now, looking forward to the day when Jesus brings that plan to a climax." Let me end with this. As I mentioned earlier, Viktor Frankl was, he was in a concentration camp, a Jewish man. Later, after he got out, he did the training. He went on to be a psychiatrist, very well-known psychiatrist. But he tells in his book some of the stories of the horrors that he dealt with in a concentration camp. Like, we just can't imagine. Anyway, at one point, he finds himself tending to the needs of the other prisoners. These are people like him who are prisoners. And he's got a bit of training at this point. And so he is trying to tend to people, kind of like a doctor. But he's tending to the elderly in some cases. Other times, people are just sick and they've got no one to take care of them. So he goes around, he finds whatever tools he can get his hands on, and he tries to take care of them. Well, a little time passes and some of the younger prisoners come to him and say, "We got a plan. We think we can escape. Do you want to come with us?" Because Frankl was still kind of young and strong. He could pull it off. "Do you want to escape with us?" And so he thought about it and he came back to the group and he said, "No, I'm going to stay." Now, why in the world would he give up a chance to get out of a concentration camp? It's because if he did, the people he was caring for wouldn't have someone who cared for them to care for them. He stayed behind to help the people who were too weak to help themselves. And you want to know who honored that decision in addition to the prisoners? The Lord. It's time to quit living as if the purpose of life is to arrive safely at death. So as Daniel himself discovered, life is not always what you plan. But just because your life isn't always what you plan, that doesn't mean you can't be a part of a plan. It doesn't mean that your life is wasted, especially as we prioritize God, honor God, know God, serve God, celebrate God, reflect God. The point is to point to Him. And all the people of God said, Amen.